Chapter 6. The Many Faces of Impermanence. Spiritual wisdom is like a many-faceted diamond. Different teachers emphasize different sides of this precious gem. For example, the Buddha put a great emphasis on how enlightenment delivers freedom from suffering. Some Zen masters, no doubt influenced by Taoism, describe it primarily in terms of becoming one with everything. The facet of wisdom that has been personally most enriching for me is impermanence. You might be wondering how impermanence could be enriching for a person. At first sight, impermanence seems at best trivial and at worst pessimistic. Trivial: everyone knows that things come and go, so what's the big deal? Pessimistic: if everything eventually passes, why bother doing anything at all? In this chapter, I will show that the notion of impermanence is neither a banality nor a bummer, but in fact the very antithesis of these, something both profound and empowering. Impermanence is the standard English translation of the Pali word anicca. Nicca means permanent, and a means not, so anicca literally means not permanent. The English word impermanence, however, does not come close to conveying the richness of that notion within the Buddhist tradition. I would say that the concept of impermanence in Buddhism is as deep and manifold as the concept of energy is in physics. If you are familiar with the history of science, you know that the concept of energy has deepened and evolved over several centuries. The same is true for the concept of impermanence in Buddhism. Just as wisdom is a jewel with many facets, the particular facet of wisdom called insight into impermanence has itself many sub-facets, many nuances and levels. In early Buddhism, impermanence was closely linked with another concept, dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering. The Buddha said that human suffering is caused by grasping. One way grasping can cause us to suffer is when we pin our happiness on things that cannot and will not last. Most people depend solely on things like health, wealth, reputation, relationships, appearance, family, or children for happiness. The problem is that these things are not eternal. People change. Our health eventually deteriorates. Wealth comes and goes. War may follow peace. All sources of conditional happiness are impermanent. In the words of Ecclesiastes, all things must pass. If we make these impermanent things the cornerstone of our happiness, then we set ourselves up for inevitable suffering, or dukkha. So in early Buddhism, impermanence had a negative connotation. We suffer because we count on impermanent things for our happiness. We pin all hope of happiness on things that will not last. But is there an alternative? Yes. Go ahead and pin some, even most, of your happiness on things that won't last. But be sure to allocate at least some time and energy for exploring the dimension of happiness that does last. Ironically, the dimension of happiness that does last is itself a facet of impermanence. It's the positive face of impermanence, the flow of Creator Spiritus that is always present, surrounding each moment of conditional happiness, embracing it from within and from without. In everyday life, we tend to perceive ourselves as objects, as things. Human languages both reflect and reinforce this perception. But in point of fact, self is not just a thing. Viewed deeply, it's also a doing, a wave. A wave is anything that goes through fluctuations, gets stronger and weaker, has peaks and troughs, spreads and subsides. Our sense of self certainly goes through such fluctuations. When you are alone at night, safe under the covers, your sense of self is somewhat diminished. On the other hand, if you walk into a room full of judgmental strangers and everybody stops to stare at you, your sense of self grows larger. It wells up as a wave, a billowing of self-referential mental talk, mental images, and emotional body sensation. Later, as you grow comfortable with the people in the room, the amplitude of that self-wave subsides a bit. When we look carefully, we discover that the sense of self is not a particle that never changes, but rather a flow, a wave of thought and feeling that can increase and decrease and is therefore not permanent. Because it is a fluctuating wave, not a solid particle, the Buddha described it as anatta. An means not, atta means self as thing. It's not so much that we don't have a self, rather it's that the self we do have is not a thing. It is an impermanent, fluctuating activity, a process, not a particle, a verb, not a noun. The Stone Buddha Dances. I sometimes ask people an intentionally weird multiple-choice question. Are the mountains dancing? The possible answers I offer are yes, no, and it depends. The answer I like is it depends. Depends on what? Two things. How minutely we investigate the mountains, and how patiently we investigate the mountains. In many languages, the word mountain is a metaphor for that which is permanent and unchanging. However, if we were to look at the mountain not at the macroscopic level of the rocks, but at the microscopic level of the molecules, we would be struck by the enormous amount of gyration, movement, and vibration. To borrow a phrase from the 1950s rock and roll star Jerry Lee Lewis, there's a whole lot of shaking going on. Below the molecular level is the atomic level. Below that is the level of protons and neutrons. And below that, quarks. And below quarks, perhaps superstrings. At each progressively subtler level, the vibrations are higher frequency and more dramatic. At the quantum level of physical reality, we find the ultimate frequency of vibration known as the Planck frequency, which is roughly a million trillion 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 cycles per second. In other words, beyond a certain spatial scale of fineness, the mountain is essentially nothing but movement. Viewed with very minute microscopic awareness, the mountain would appear to be a literal dance of energy. That's the spatial perspective. Now let's talk about the temporal perspective. If we look at a mountain for 10 years, it doesn't seem to change very much. However, if we took a time-lapse video, a shot each century for millions of years, then played the film back at regular speed, what would the mountain look like? It would look like streaming protoplasm, undulating with a graceful fluid motion, expanding here, contracting there. In other words, if we look in slow motion, we see all sorts of movement that we would not see otherwise. How is this relevant to ordinary sensory experience? Is there something we can do that is analogous to seeing in slow motion? Yes, if we look patiently enough, if we have great equanimity, we will be thrust into an altered state where time dramatically slows down. You might have experienced something like this in your own life, perhaps associated with a dramatically life-threatening situation or a dramatically life-affirming situation. Everything seemed to run in slow motion, and you were looking as from a distance, unafraid, knowing exactly what to do and having seemingly an eternity to do it. In the language of mindfulness, you spontaneously dropped into a state of profound equanimity. Within that state, it is possible to experience self and world, ordinarily so solid, as a kind of effortless flow. Viewed with the patience of centuries, from deep equanimity, or with the precision of the microscopic, with great sensory clarity, seemingly solid experiences are in fact a dance of energy. This holds true for all our experiences, from the most ordinary to the most outré. We may say that a certain sensation seems very solid, a certain thought seems very gripping. We look at the wall, and it seems unchanging and rigid. However, if we can look patiently enough and precisely enough, if we have sufficient clarity and equanimity, then our moment-by-moment sensory experience is an effortless flow of impermanence. There is an ancient Zen book that gives a criterion whereby you can know if you are enlightened or not. The criterion goes like this. If you visit a temple, and the stone Buddha on the altar dances for you, then you are enlightened. Now, is this just some sort of zany Zen metaphor intentionally designed to blow your mind? Not at all. They mean it quite literally. The question is, how can a stone Buddha dance? Let's say that you're in a Chinese temple, looking at a giant stone Buddha. You look to the right, look to the left, then you look at his belly, look at his leg. Then look over the entire sculpture at once. Your vision flows over the stone Buddha, and each time there is an eye shift, a completely new visual impression of the stone Buddha arises. Most people are not explicitly aware of this constant visual shifting in day-to-day life. During a typical day, how many times does your head turn? How many times do your eyes move from one side to another? How many saccades, small shifts in your visual axis, occur? Neuroscientists estimate that it's about 100,000, and with each shift, a new world arises and an old world dies. Typically, we don't consciously notice such transitions. They are all part of the automatic processing of the brain. However, if we trained ourselves to be mindful in visual space, we would be aware that moment by moment, at all sorts of spatial and temporal scales, the center of our visual awareness is constantly shifting within the so-called material world. We would also notice that at each one of those shifts, something wells up, but something also subsides. At first, it might be something like snapshots taken at different angles. But as your visual mindfulness deepens, you would begin to see a smooth and continuous flow of visual welling up and subsiding. It is very much like the graceful movements of a jellyfish, or seaweed in a tide pool, or like the movements of the earth if seen in time-lapse photography. The world becomes soft, pliant, and elastic. It's like a fluid version of one of those Picasso paintings where you see a face from many angles. Picasso was trying to portray what our visual field actually does, to paint this dynamic 3D process on a static 2D surface. The stone Buddha comes to life through the dance of your eyes. Masks of impermanence. When we really attend to what is, we become aware that impermanence is characteristic of all our experiences, even the experiences that seem very permanent. If we look carefully enough and patiently enough, any experience will show us its impermanence. That is important and useful, because impermanence can turbocharge our spiritual growth. In order for that to happen, we have to be able to detect the impermanence. So I would like to describe some of the guises in which it presents itself. Frequently, students tell me that they haven't experienced impermanence yet, or that they would like to experience it, or that they don't understand what I mean by it. This indicates to me that they are thinking that impermanence is something special. It's not. It's something ordinary that will become extraordinary if you consistently pay enough attention to it for a long enough time. If you have ever had a pain that got stronger and then weaker, you have experienced impermanence. If you have ever heard a sound get louder and then fade, you have experienced impermanence. If you've ever watched your mind get agitated and then calm down, you have experienced impermanence. Seen this way, no human being can claim they have not experienced impermanence. When people say things like, "I have not experienced impermanence yet," what they mean is that they have not reached the point where impermanence informs and empowers them in a significant way. So how does one come to an extraordinary experience of impermanence? An experience of impermanence that alters one's worldview and liberates one's mind and body. This comes about by carefully paying attention to ordinary impermanence consistently for a long period of time. Impermanence is simply the changingness of experience, and everybody has contact with the changingness of experience. However, most people have not developed an intimacy with the changingness of experience. They may not have the sensitive radar to detect its various guises. They may not have cultivated a palate that appreciates all its subtle flavors. They may not have realized its earth-shaking potential. They may not appreciate its ubiquity. But no one can say that they have not experienced impermanence. When Buddhists talk about having insight into impermanence, they just mean appreciating the normal changingness of experience at deeper levels of poignancy. One way to think about this is in terms of three aspects: the trivial aspect of impermanence, the harsh aspect of impermanence, and the blissful aspect of impermanence. Let's look at each of these a little more closely. At first, impermanence may present itself in a kind of trivial way. For example, you're meditating and you start feeling an itch. You get preoccupied with it for a while, and something distracts you, and when you come back, the itch is gone. You didn't actually feel it go. You're just aware that something previously present is now absent. Your attention was broken, but you still noticed that something changed. This level of understanding impermanence is based on a lack of continuous concentration. A deeper appreciation of impermanence comes about through continuous concentration. As your concentration skills grow, and you're able to focus on things more continuously without being distracted, you begin to appreciate how things continuously change. But continuous change does not necessarily imply smooth change. At this stage, your experience of change may be abrupt, jagged, perhaps even harsh. For example, you're watching a pain in your leg, and you notice that it is pounding, twisting, stabbing, shooting, crushing, or exploding. Now, these are very abrupt and uncomfortable modes of movement, but they are movement nonetheless. They are ways in which the pain sensation is changing. It seems like somebody has stuck a knife in your leg and is twisting it to the right, to the left, jabbing it in, pulling it out. It is harsh, it is abrupt, it is jagged, but it represents a continuous contact with changingness. This doesn't happen only with painful experiences. The same can happen with intense pleasure. For example, during lovemaking, you may have continuous contact with strong pleasure sensations. But because of craving, these sensations impact the body in a harsh and jagged way. There's intensity, yes, but it's coagulated and driven. It fails to deliver the smooth, easy waves of timeless fulfillment that love was meant to be. Eventually, your concentration and equanimity skills mature to the point where your experience of change is not only continuous, but smooth as well. A softening takes place. The impermanence becomes fluid, soothing, bubbly, more like an effortless breathing in and out. This is because your focus is like a high-resolution monitor or a high-definition TV screen, and you're able to perceive subtler movements with clarity. To make a techie metaphor, it's as if you have increased the sampling rate or bandwidth of your change detector. You can't force this to happen, but as you're paying attention and developing an acceptance of the harsher kinds of impermanence, they break up into gentler kinds of impermanence. Stately undulations, effervescence, effortless spread, and collapse. When this happens, the impermanence starts to comfort you. It becomes like a massage. In point of fact, even when it was pounding, cutting, crushing, and exploding, it really was massaging you. But that's a kind of rubdown that you don't quite recognize as a rubdown, because it was just a little bit too harsh. It's like the difference between light Swedish massage and intense deep tissue massage. Unfortunately, nature often starts out with the intense deep massage mode, and we do not realize that we're being massaged. We may think we're being tortured, but we have to be willing to go with it. If it wants to pound, let it pound. If it wants to twist, let it twist. If it wants to crush, let it crush. Through that, some of the gross resistance to the flow of impermanence gets broken down, although it may not seem like it at first. At some point, you will experience the gentler aspects of impermanence, the soft massage style. I describe this third stage of impermanence as a pleasant flow of energy, a smooth, effortless effervescence that's nurturing and enlivening. At this point, we are on the edge of an important transition, because now we can yield to the flow and let it meditate us. The perception, "I am meditating," fades into the background and is replaced by the perception that impermanence is meditating me. You can think of impermanence in this guise as your helper in meditation. The great Burmese master Ubakin had an interesting and useful way of talking about impermanence, which I am sure was never used in earlier Buddhism. He spoke of activating impermanence. At some point, you may experience impermanence as a kind of energy that has been activated within you and helps you along with the meditation. It is a kind of impermanence you can ride and surf. In Hindu meditation, this is sometimes called Kundalini or Shakti. Here is where we start to perceive an aspect of impermanence that is more positive than the earlier association of impermanence with suffering. Instead of only representing a pessimistic philosophy, we are now talking about a helper along the path. As far as I know, the Buddha never explicitly talked about impermanence in such terms. I think we should have a name for the positive side to impermanence. So in my system, I call it flow. I find having a word that emphasizes the positive side of impermanence very useful in teaching Anicca to the modern world. Flow itself comes in many different flavors. The main forms of flow I like to distinguish are undulatory flow, vibratory flow, and expansion-contraction flow. Undulatory flow is continuous, wavy movement, like a jellyfish, an amoeba, or a lava lamp. Most people initially experience this flavor of flow over their whole body. The whole body feels like seaweed in a tide pool. Vibratory flow is like champagne bubbles or sparks of electricity. If you have ever experienced the high that runners enjoy or the pump that weightlifters speak of, you have contacted this flavor of flow. A similar feeling is the vibratory sensation you get after taking an invigorating shower, or the glow feeling you have after making love, or the endorphin rush some people seek. If you have enough microscopic clarity, You'll discover these pleasure types are really flow in the form of scintillating mist or effervescent champagne bubbles throughout your body. Taking a run, or an invigorating shower, or making love. What do each of these experiences have in common? Each one of them represents an intense experience of body. In the relaxed period that follows, if you observe microscopically, you will discover a fine vibratory phenomenon. This is, in fact, the nature of all body experience, but it is easier to detect at such times because of the intense involvement with the body that preceded. Expansion-contraction flow involves inward and outward movements, stretching and squeezing forces, effortless puffing out and equally effortless collapsing in. It's not uncommon in meditation for people to get a sense of vastness that encompasses everything and a sense of lightness that pervades everything. But look carefully. That immense vastness is not static. It's a dynamic force that spreads outward. And that pervasive lightness is not static. It propagates a flavor of contractive thinness, constantly calling consciousness back to the dimensionless point whence it arises. Expansion-contraction flow is fundamental in that it underlies all other flavors of flow. All three, undulation, vibration, and expansion-contraction, are often present at the same time. For many people, their first experience of flow is in the body. Later, they will begin to notice various flavors of flow in the other senses, including the thinking process itself. Of course, not everybody experiences impermanence in the ways I've described, and you certainly should not struggle trying to get experiences of undulations, vibrations, or expansion-contraction. However, if you do experience flow, either as a result of formal meditation or spontaneously as the result of everyday living, it is useful to understand what it signifies and how to work with it. Before we go further, I need to make one minor point regarding terminology. Technical terms mean different things in different contexts. In the field of positive psychology, flow refers to the intrinsic reward associated with a highly concentrated state, a topic we discussed earlier in this book. It has come into popular use in that sense. It's not unusual to hear people say things like, "I entered a flow state," by which they mean they entered a state of enjoyable concentration. It's wonderful that we now have a commonly known English word for that phenomenon. So we should thank positive psychologists like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi for that. However, notice that within my formulation, flow refers to dynamic qualities that may be present within sensory experience, change, energy, force, movement, and such. In terms of science, detecting flow corresponds to taking the time derivative of sensory experience. Obviously, flow as spoken of in positive psychology and flow as spoken of within my system have a natural relationship. The former facilitates the latter. Flow as purifier. When a body worker massages you, that person's fingers move through the substance of your muscles and transfer energy into them. This works out the kinks and lumps in the substance of the muscles. This is a good analogy for the flow of impermanence. When you let impermanence work on you, the energy in its waves and vibrations softens the substance of consciousness, works out knots in your soul. It breaks up the coagulated places in all your senses, visual, auditory, and somatic. This is impermanence as a purifier, something that breaks up blockages, cleans out impurities, refines the ore of who you are. As this is happening, it may seem as though consciousness is becoming porous. Within that porosity, you can feel Anicca's waves and vibrations churning up gunk from the depths of your soul. They push gunk up, digest it, then excrete it from your being. You can feel your senses being scoured by the flow of impermanence. The cleansing of the doors of perception is not a poetic metaphor. It's a palpable reality. Impermanence is related to central ideas found in various spiritual traditions. The words used may not initially look anything like impermanence. If you just looked at their literal meaning, you would never in your wildest dreams imagine that they had anything to do with what Buddhists call impermanence. For example, Chinese culture recognizes something called qi, which is described as a kind of energy that flows in channels through a person's body. The East Asian medical, martial notion of qi is closely related to the Buddhist experience of impermanence. If you receive an acupuncture treatment and really tune in to what is happening with the needles, You will detect what in Chinese is called duchi, getting qi. You feel expanding, contracting, vibrating waves going out from that needle, doing stuff that seems to be good for your body. You might not think that would be related to a philosophical concept like impermanence, but it is. As you'll remember, in Buddhist practice, we get insight into impermanence by being very precise and very open to things. When the acupuncturist puts a needle in your skin, the pinprick produces a sensation of pain. It's not a big sensation, nothing more than a mosquito bite, so it is fairly easy to be completely open to that sensation, especially if you believe that the needle is going to help you. When you're needled in acupuncture, it is easy to have equanimity with these little pinpricks. It is also easy to be very precise about them, very mindful about exactly where they are located. In English, we even have a verb, to pinpoint, meaning to be spatially precise about something. Receiving acupuncture automatically gives you an experience of precise and accepting awareness of the body. But this is exactly what we do in mindfulness practice. When we develop body mindfulness, we attempt to be very precise about the locations of sensations, and we try to have equanimity with them to the best of our ability. In essence, we take the ordinary aches and pains we experience while sitting and convert them into a kind of acupuncture stimulus. As a result of pinpointing them and opening to them, they start to flow and vibrate, creating an experience analogous to the duchi of acupuncture. I'd like to clarify something about the relationship between the Taoist notion of qi and the Buddhist teachings on impermanence. People familiar with the Buddhist tradition tend to associate the concept of impermanence with two things: the nature of objective reality and the ubiquity of suffering. Everything that is compounded eventually passes away. So if we pin all of our happiness on people, objects, and situations, we set ourselves up for inevitable and perhaps horrific suffering. This aspect of impermanence is an important and useful philosophical statement. But there's also an experiential side to impermanence. As we carefully observe our senses, we become poignantly aware of their vibrant, vibratory, and dynamically spacious nature. Qi is usually conceived of as an objectively existing entity that can be controlled and manipulated. But what's the historical origin of this concept? I suspect that it originally arose as a result of people detecting energy flows in their body and noticing how those flows tend to move in certain patterns. Whether qi objectively exists as a physical force is contentious, but as a sensory experience, its significance is undeniable. Therein lies the link between Buddhist impermanence and Taoist energy. As intellectual concepts, they seem quite different, but as sensory experiences, they're closely related. Impermanence is also related to what is called the Holy Spirit in the Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. The phrase Holy Spirit may sound sort of mystical, schmystical, maybe even annoying or intimidating or off-putting. But the English words Holy Spirit come from the Latin Spiritus Sanctus, which in turn is just a translation of the Greek Aia Numa, which itself is a translation of the Hebrew Ruach HaKodesh. In Hebrew, Ruach means the wind, something that has power but is insubstantial and constantly moving. The Holy Spirit is a kind of wind that blows through us and comforts us. It is the Paraclete, the Comforter that purifies us and links us to our source. See chapter 10 for a Christian take on how the Holy Spirit dissolves the somethingness of self. So activating impermanence, receiving the Holy Spirit, and getting qi are very different phrases based on very different paradigms, but as experiences, they can be closely related. On the spiritual path, one has to develop a sensitivity to vocabulary. Two teachers may use very similar vocabulary and yet be referring to rather different things. On the other hand, two teachers may use words that do not seem similar at all, but that actually refer to related phenomena. Developing discernment, a sensitivity to how words are used in different contexts, is a benchmark of spiritual maturity. 45 years ago, I was studying languages and philosophy in graduate school, and I had never done any meditation practice. If somebody had said to me, "Several decades from now, you will be stating in print that the Judeo-Christian concept of the Holy Spirit, the martial arts concept of qi, and the Buddhist concept of anicca are related," I probably would have said, "Please shoot me now." As a scholar, I thought these concepts had absolutely nothing to do with each other, that they possessed no connection historically, linguistically, or conceptually. But that was before I had experience. Experience transformed me from a dignified academician into someone spouting seeming non sequiturs. That's impermanence. This idea that impermanence can be a positive, purifying force is revolutionary. At first, the notion of impermanence may scare us a little bit, because it seems to remove all sense of security. If everything in the universe changes and vanishes, then there would seem to be nothing upon which we can rely. The only thing that doesn't change and vanish is the changing and vanishing itself. But as we have seen, that changing and vanishing can become a powerful source of comfort and security. There is a sort of taste we get when we become aware that the flow of impermanence is purifying and cleansing us. For lack of a better term, I call it the taste of purification. The ability to taste purification is the sign of a mature spiritual palate, so to speak. Children usually cannot understand how an adult could possibly like a bitter taste such as coffee, or a burning taste such as hot chili. But as we grow older, we come to appreciate and seek flavors that children don't. We call this the maturing of the palate. The same thing can happen with our spiritual palate. As our spiritual taste buds mature, we begin to savor certain qualities that we couldn't detect or appreciate previously. The taste of purification is very hard to describe, but in essence, it is a kind of joy. You may be in great pain, but there's a deep joy because you feel blockages being worked out each time you greet the pain with equanimity. You can feel how the energy in the pain is wearing away the separation between you and your spiritual source. You sense that holdings from the past are being ground up, digested, and metabolized by the peristaltic and vibratory movements of impermanence. The grinding and digesting is both painful and liberating at the same time. This is the taste of purification. Once you're able to detect and appreciate this taste, you become capable of doing practices that were unthinkable when you began your meditation career. To develop this taste, you have to start somewhere. You can begin with experiences that are relatively easy and not too overwhelming. For example, you can sit and watch itches or little aches and pains come and go in your body. When we meditate, often we will simply observe an itch without necessarily scratching it, or we will sit with a straight back, even though the muscles may be a bit tired. These are little things that anybody can do. If we do this enough, we start to get a sense of what that taste of purification is like. Then we are not afraid to do the same with sensations that are a little more intense, or perhaps a lot more intense. We do not have to actively seek out uncomfortable situations in order to purify our consciousness. We can just wait for life to give them to us, which it always does sooner or later. If we understand the taste of purification, we will not be frightened by the prospect of the unpleasant things that will happen in this life. Eventually, we will encounter intense discomforts, things that we wish were not happening. But if we understand about the taste of purification, all the discomforts that we will have to face are guaranteed to have a silver lining. It is good to practice with small things so that you will have a momentum going for you when things get heavy. Some people are drawn to actively seeking intensely challenging situations, not just little things like itches and aches. Why would someone do that? In order to put themselves in a situation where they will literally be driven into a state of equanimity and flow by the sheer intensity of the ordeal. Those of us who have lived in Asia and participated in traditional monastic training love to tell what I call Buddhist war stories. These are stories about the really intense stuff that we did or saw in Asia. There's a danger in telling these stories, however, because when people hear them, they may well say to themselves, "If that is what I have to do to get enlightenment, I think I will try it in another lifetime." But it is certainly not the case that heavy-duty practice is absolutely required for enlightenment. The issue is to experience things fully, be it an itch, an ache, or for that matter, a pleasant sensation like smiling. You could travel the entire path to enlightenment if you had a radically complete experience of your smile every time you smiled. If every single time you smiled for the rest of your life, you infused it with total concentration, clarity, and equanimity, you would discover in the midst of the smile that the facial muscles contract and the smile sensation expands simultaneously. Both sides of impermanence are there working together to manifest the self of the moment as a smile. Indeed, You would eventually experience all the expansion and contraction, all the yang and yin of the universe inside your day-to-day smile. So something as mild and ordinary as a smile has the potential to bring the same level of enlightenment as the intense and strange ordeal that I am about to describe. When I lived in Asian monasteries, I observed mind-boggling intensities of practice. But what struck me was that these austerities were by and large not done with white-knuckled endurance. Rather, they were done with a smile on the face and a lightness in the body, because monks did not undertake these practices until they were ready. By that, I mean that they had developed a momentum of the purifying force of impermanence. For such people, when things become intense, the taste of purification will immediately arise. The reward is instant, so the ordeal does not degenerate into a grim endurance contest. There is a tradition of going to special places in order to do intense practice. For example, early Christians went into the desert, Tibetans go into caves, and Theravada monks go into forests. In Greece, the most famous center of Christian contemplation is on Mount Athos. Japan has two equivalents to Mount Athos, Mount Koya, where I was ordained in 1970 as a Shingon monk, and Mount Hiei. The English language guidebooks always compare Mount Koya to Mount Athos. They are both mountains in remote areas with a harsh physical environment. Originally, there was nothing but monasteries on Mount Koya, and no women were allowed. The no women rule was abandoned on Mount Koya quite a while ago, although I think it's still observed on Mount Athos. You may recall that my initial training in Shingon meditation occurred during 100 days of continuous practice in isolation, in the dead of winter, and in total silence. I went in one person, a scattered, wimpy, would-be scholar, and came out quite a different person. Not enlightened, but incomparably more focused and courageous. As far as I'm aware, I was the first Westerner to ever complete the Shingon basic training. By the end of that, I thought I was pretty hot stuff. My best friend at the time was a monk of the Tendai school who had studied on Mount Hiei near Kyoto, the old capital of Japan. When I completed my 100-day training, he suggested that I go meet his teacher on Mount Hiei. It turned out that his teacher was one of a small group of extraordinary ascetics, sometimes referred to as the Marathon Monks of Mount Hiei. Recall that I thought I was pretty tough, because I had done 100 days in isolation. By way of contrast, marathon monks commit to 12 years in isolation. During those 12 years, they must undertake several seemingly impossible ordeals. For example, they have to walk down the mountain, go into the city of Kyoto, visit every major shrine and temple in the city, chant the appropriate mantra in front of it, and then climb back up the mountain. This cycle takes over 20 hours, and they must do it for 100 days in succession, once each year, for 12 years. That leaves a few hours to sleep, and the rest of the time they are hiking and chanting mantras for over 3 months. It is almost an inconceivable ordeal, but I've seen it done with a smile on the face. Why? Because in each moment, they are tangibly aware that this austerity is doing something for them. They can actually feel the purification happening despite the intensity. Eventually, this taste of purification gets so strong and delicious that it eclipses the pain. Twice during this 12-year period, they have to do a special ceremony in which they essentially sit for 9 days without eating, sleeping, or taking liquids. You might think this is a legend, or perhaps even a pious fraud, but it is a public event. In fact, it is sometimes televised live on Japanese network TV. The master I talked to said that the first 2 days of the 9-day sit were pretty rough, but after that it wasn't so bad. The momentum of impermanence and purification just took over, and the time went fairly quickly. He told me, however, that afterward it took him a full month to recover his normal sleeping cycle. You might think that this is pretty interesting, but what, after all, is the point of such austerity? Did all that intensity do any good? After completing his 12 years, what was this man like in terms of his day-to-day functioning? From what I observed, my friend's teacher spent his days serving people. They would come to visit him with their problems. They might need some counseling or encouragement or advice or inspiration. Certainly, meeting with someone like him would provide living proof that no matter what you are going through in your life, you can get through it and perhaps be empowered by it, just as he had been. He became an inspiring figure for masses of ordinary people who would come just to talk and sit with him. Now, all of this may seem rather foreign, exotic and remote from your reality. You may well be wondering what it has to do with you. But it is totally relevant to the lives of ordinary modern people. There is every probability that a person who lives a comfortable life in, say, North America, will still have to go through experiences comparable in intensity to those of the Marathon monks, because something will happen to them directly or to someone they care about deeply. For example, when my father died of lung cancer, I watched him go a week without sleeping, hyperventilating 24 hours a day, slowly suffocating to death. This is certainly as physically intense as anything undertaken by monks at Mount Hiei. He had all the best care that Western medicine could provide, and all the amenities of middle-class North American life, yet he still had to face that reality. I don't know to what extent he was subjectively aware of it, but as an outside observer, I could certainly see all the types of impermanence working within him, grinding away his somethingness. I think he was probably aware of this at some level, despite the fact that he couldn't speak to say so. Even though he had never meditated, and he had no explicit spiritual path, he had lived as a really good person, and everybody liked him. That good karma was there, and even though he had no background in concepts like the purifying action of impermanence, his basic goodness must have helped him. So the kinds of austerities and intensities that people put themselves through in traditional training may at some point become reality for you, even if you do your best to avoid discomfort. Impermanence as a purifier can in some ways be compared to the process of digestion. During digestion, the peristalsis, or undulation of the stomach and the intestines, helps break the food down into its components. Then, what is useful among its components is absorbed and becomes part of our mass and energy, and what is not useful is excreted by further peristalsis. I have talked about the notion that we all have a sort of pool of poison and pain within us, deep down in the subconscious, that consists of holdings from the past, what might be described as a layer of residue. When impermanence is experienced in its purificatory guise, we can literally feel its peristaltic movements reaching down into this pain body and breaking it up into a kind of energy. The impermanence absorbs what is nutritive from the past to enhance the content of our being. We can also feel it sort of excreting what is not nutritive, a kind of releasing process wherein spiritually toxic aspects of this residue are expelled. I realize that this may sound a bit weird and maybe even gross. However, the experience itself is quite natural and very beautiful. Fuel for the spiritual reactor. When we speak of the flow of impermanence, it is very important to realize that it is not something separate from ordinary experience. There is not some special world of flowing energy from which we must eventually be pulled away back into the clunky and lumpy ordinary world. On the contrary, the energy flow is the ordinary world. It's what happens to the ordinary world when that world is experienced with extraordinary attentiveness. In the science of enlightenment, complete experience is the name of the game. Some people who encounter flow don't realize this, and so they fall into the belief that the world is one thing and spirit quite another. This creates a conceptual dichotomy between spirit and matter, between God and the world. This is a very common misconception, and in a way, it is easy to see how people could fall into it. But flow, spirit, chi are just what happens to the ordinary senses when they are experienced with extraordinary concentration, clarity, and equanimity. God is what the world looks like when experienced with radical fullness. Spirit is what matter tastes like when it's tasted to the core. When people experience flow in any of its pleasant flavors, expansion, contraction, undulation, vibration, bubbles, electricity, kundalini, there is a tendency to want to focus only on that, to see that as the good stuff, the goal of meditation. But the goal of meditation is something deeper and more subtle. The goal of meditation is to gain insight, to know that spirit energy is simply what happens to ordinary experience when it is greeted with extraordinary attention. Conversely, the materiality of objects, the somethingness of the self, the rigidity of space, and the linearity of time are simply what happens to spirit when it encounters the nebulosity and viscosity of the untrained human nervous system. This reminds me of Einstein's famous statement that matter is frozen energy. Strictly speaking, my comment about the untrained nervous system is not quite accurate. The actual situation is more complex. During the first few hundred milliseconds of preconscious processing, every experience is a flow of pure spirit. Nebulosity and viscosity enter in a bit later as we become conscious of the experience. So there are two sides to spiritual training. One side involves developing clarity and equanimity. Clarity reduces nebulosity, and equanimity reduces viscosity. The other side of training involves detecting the momentary primordial perfection that's always there for everyone. Success with that second side of training brings you to the realization that you never needed to do any training. I'll talk more about this in Chapter 10. In order for insight into impermanence to occur, we have to make the following correlation over and over again. An ordinary, solid, sensory event arises. We greet it with concentration, clarity, and equanimity. As a result, it eventually breaks up into flow. In order to go through this three-step process enough times, we have to be willing to look at the parts of our experience that are still solid and separate. That means that we have to be willing, and indeed enthusiastic, about the prospect of focusing on what is solid and opaque, and not want to focus only on what is fluid and transparent. When you start to experience flow and energy, if you only want to experience that, and are not equally interested in watching ordinary, solidified, objectified sensory events, then your spiritual path will be self-limiting. You will dissolve to a certain degree, but be unable to go any deeper, because your spiritual reactor has run out of fuel. E equals MC squared. The source of further energy, E, lies in your remnant mass, M, the ordinary, coagulated, opaque sensory arisings. There's a natural alternating process, like the cycle of the seasons. We freeze, we melt. We freeze, we melt. But with each repetition, the freezing becomes more subtle, which allows for the subsequent melting to be even deeper. Understanding the non-duality of spirit energy and ordinary experience is very important. We must watch how ordinary experience becomes waves of impermanence over and over, 100 times, 1,000 times, 100,000 times, before we really believe that all ordinary experience is impermanent. Eventually, it sinks in. Every statue dances. When flow is unimpeded, we say that we are living in the world of oneness and spirit. When flow stiffens up, we say that we are in the world of separateness and materiality. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the world of separateness and materiality, as long as it is not the only world in which we are constrained to live. Unfortunately, this is exactly the case for the great majority of human beings. They are constrained to live in rigid space and linear time. Ridiculous, the waste, sad time stretching before and after. T.S. Eliot, Bernd Norton. Flow as guide. When Christians speak of the Holy Spirit, they describe it not only as that which comforts and purifies, but also that which guides. And indeed, another of the many masks of impermanence is that of a guide. For one thing, impermanence can function as a kind of feedback loop, because it tells us when we are approaching complete experience. As concentration, clarity, and equanimity deepen, the experience presents itself more as wave, less as particle. But impermanence is also a guide in another sense. When people talk about having an inner guide, they usually mean an archetypical figure that communicates to them through internal talk and mental images. Yes, you can call this an inner guide if you want, but it is not the innermost guide. The innermost guide does not teach through words or archetypal visions, but rather by example. That no doubt sounds somewhat enigmatic. Let me try to explain. The flow of impermanence functions without any will or desire. It's a kind of effortless effervescence. As we encounter this effervescence, it begins to inform our entire being, and we begin to take on some of its qualities. At the microscopic, preconscious level, every human being functions as an effortless flow of nature. But at the macroscopic, conscious level, there are all sorts of push and pull, drivenness, rigidity, and solidity. When we encounter the effortlessness of flow at the microscopic level of our being, some of that effortlessness begins to inform the macroscopic level of our being and teaches us by example. The metaphor I use is an extremely undignified one given the nobility of the experience. Nevertheless, I can't resist using it. Consider an Alka-Seltzer tablet. It is quite solid. However, it does have a certain potential inside it, and that potential becomes activated when we drop the tablet into water. Lo and behold, out of that solidity, a great deal of fizz arises. The more fizz there is, the more quickly the solidity of the tablet disappears, until it literally dissolves itself. In the same way, we have a very solid sense of self, a very solid sense of body, a very rigid sense of space, and a very congealed sense of matter. If we drop those solid tablets into the waters of concentration, clarity, and equanimity, lo and behold, something gets activated. All we have to do is keep that bubbly part next to the solid part, and the bubbly part starts to influence the solid part. It presents a model. It teaches the solid part. Eventually, the big, gross, congealed part simply gives itself back to the bubbles and becomes nothing but bubbles. In other words, the parts of us that are in flow show the parts that are not in flow how to be in flow. Flow sets up a positive feedback loop. The more we attend to some part that's in flow, the more that flow informs all our parts. Flow as unifier. Another facet of flow is as an integrator or unifier. At the beginning of mindfulness practice, our job is to make distinctions. We have to make a clear distinction between mental experience and somatic experience, so that when these two arise together, they don't tangle and cross-multiply. We discover that when we are able to keep these two domains of experience distinct, they merely add together and are manageable. But when they become conflated, they multiply with each other into overwhelm. Going further, we learn to break mental experience into visual thinking, mental image, and verbal thinking, mental talk. And we learn to break somatic experience into emotional flavors and physical flavors. All these are empowering distinctions. Being able to track our thinking process in terms of visual and auditory components allows us to experience thought as a tangible sensory event. Being able to detect the often subtle emotional flavors that arise in the body prevents them from distorting our perception and behavior. We learn to distinguish outer stimuli, physical sights, physical sounds, physical body sensations, from inner reactions to them, mental image, mental talk, emotional body sensation. The English word mindfulness is roughly equivalent to the Pali word vipassana. The prefix V in Pali implies separation, and passana means to see. But as this process of seeing as separate reaches finer and finer levels, we start to experience a commonality. When you study anatomy, at first you learn to distinguish the various organs and their parts. But when you get to the cellular level, you realize that there is a unifying principle underlying the separate components of the body. Furthermore, at the level of that unifying principle, the human body, the body of a worm, and even the body of a tree are composed of essentially the same building blocks, cells. In the same way, at a microscopic level of observation, the mental images, internal talk, and emotional feelings that constitute the I can all be experienced as being made of the same stuff, the vibrating flow of impermanence. This realization integrates your personality at a profound level. Your personality becomes a single flow, a pure doing, an integrated activity. This is what is behind the apparent paradox that those who vehemently claim that there is no such thing as a self usually have powerful, impactful personalities. Moreover, the same flow of impermanence that makes up the inner world of thought and emotion also makes up the outer world of physical sight, physical sound, and physical body sensations. In other words, both the I and the it are made of the same stuff, flow. This realization breaks down the fundamental barrier between inside and outside, unifying the subjective and the objective into a single I-thou doing. When we tune into the impermanence deeply enough, there is no fundamental distinction between mind and body, or between inside and outside. A single arabesque of energy cuts across everything. Imagine a valley containing several kinds of vegetation that are quite distinct. Imagine also that wind is continuously blowing through that valley. If you focus on the different kinds of vegetation themselves, you get a sense of separateness. If you focus on how the wind moves through them, you get a sense of unity. In the same way, as you attend to the inner sensory activity as a wave and the outer sensory activity as a wave, the two waves flow together into a single integrated self-world wave. This could be described as an experience of merging, a passing away of the separation between inside and outside. By having experiences like this many, many times, two deep sources of suffering begin to disappear, our fundamental alienation and our deep-seated fear. When all that we see, hear, or feel begins to flow, then it all becomes like one taste. The impermanence taste. The flow taste. Flow is the great leveler. It breaks down distinctions in an empowering way. A person on a mature spiritual path becomes familiar with both empowering distinctions and empowering unifications. The unifications break down the distinctions, paving the way for detecting even finer distinctions, which are then broken down to create an even deeper unification. Imagine that you hear a sound in the outside world, for example, the sound of a bird singing. When this sound is experienced as flow, you have the sense of sound as a rising and falling waveform. At the same time, in your mind's eye, you might see a bird, but that too is a wave, an image wave, a wave of internal light that rises onto your mental screen for a while and then ebbs away. At the same time still, you might have a feeling reaction to the bird's song, one of joy, for example. This joy is also experienced as a rising then subsiding wave of pleasure in the body. Rather than three discrete objects of sense experience, bird song, bird image, and bird joy, you experience three interpenetrating bubbly waves that integrate into one bubbly wave. You experience it as an unbroken flow of sensory motion rather than separate chunks of sensory impressions. Oneness is no longer a philosophical abstraction. It is now a daily sensory reality. Sasaki Roshi had a very eccentric way of talking. For example, sometimes instead of calling a pine tree by its usual Japanese name, Matsunoki, he would say Matsunoki toyu hataraki, which means the activity called pine tree. He also used phrases like Ninsen toyu hataraki, the activity called human being, and Kami toyu hataraki, the activity called God. This is a very idiosyncratic use of the Japanese language. He talked this way to remind people that all the objects in the world can be experienced as waves of impermanence, not just as concrete separate things. So impermanence is a unifier, in that it gives an underlying characteristic that unifies mind and body, inside and outside. We come to experience things in terms of their activity. Every individual thing in the universe has its wave nature, and therefore, the universe itself can be thought of as an integrated world wave. When we experience a grain of sand, its grain wave is united with the universe wave. This sounds nice, but what does it actually mean? Well, to see a grain of sand means something is arising in external sight space. In order to know that it is a grain of sand, visual associations must arise in your image space. Those visual associations are usually below the threshold of awareness. Furthermore, each visual association triggers a cascade of subtler visual associations, and each of those subtle visual associations triggers yet another cascade of even subtler visual associations. The wave of visual association spreads wider and wider, but as it spreads, its components get finer and finer. To borrow a notion from calculus, that association wave points to the whole universe in the limit. If equanimity is not deep, the intense see-out physical sight and the subtle see-in mental image are both coagulated, and you have the ordinary experience of an I looking at an it. But if the see-out of the sand and the see-in visual association are not fixated, they become a single wave. The entire universe points to the grain of sand as its child, and the grain of sand points to the entire universe as its parent. Admittedly, that sounds a little mystical-schmystical. Here's what I mean. In the objective world, there's a pyramid of physical causality that lies behind the grain. The base of that pyramid spreads out to encompass the entire universe, because any one thing comes from a relational net that is ultimately connected to everything. On the other hand, there's a visual association wave triggered in you by the sight of the grain of sand. Although that association wave may not literally include everything in your subconscious, it implicitly points to your whole inner imago mundi. The grain of sand triggers subliminal mental images. That's what allows you to understand the grain of sand in context. However, each of those associated images requires its own wave of association, and each of those associated images sets off an even finer wave of associations. Of course, this does not actually go on forever, but it does potentially point to everything you've ever seen or could even imagine seeing. It's a little bit like how light propagates. Each point on the spreading spherical wavefront becomes a new source for another spherical wavefront. All this happens below the threshold of awareness. An experienced meditator can detect these spreading waves of association constantly happening in image space. Because the content is below the threshold of awareness, the wave is, in a sense, empty. But because it points to everything that you know or can imagine, it's also huge. Taken together, the combined experience is a simultaneous sense of vastness, thinness, and all-encompassing connectivity. In the objective world, the grain of sand arises through a converging net of physical connections. And in the observer's consciousness, the grain of sand is understood through a diverging net of mental associations. A relational net converges from the whole world, creating a product, grain of sand. An associational net diverges to your whole mind, creating a concept, grain of sand. Matter and mind are dual in the mathematical sense of that word. They are partial mirror images of each other, inverse lattices, so to speak. As William Blake wrote, you really do see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. Flow as the spiritual source. We have talked about many facets, many modes, many functions of impermanence. We have talked about impermanence as sort of a pessimistic worldview. We have talked about impermanence as a characteristic of experience. We have talked about impermanence as something that helps us along in our meditation. We have also talked about impermanence as an integrator that frees us from our fundamental alienation and connects us to the all. There is, however, one more facet to impermanence, and it is this facet that I personally find most fascinating. However, until you have experienced some of the other aspects of impermanence, this final aspect may seem enigmatic, esoteric, and irrelevant. If what I'm about to say strikes you as nonsense, I hope that you will just hear the words and have equanimity with any confusion and annoyance that may arise. Sometimes we have to be satisfied with wisdom at the level of just remembering someone's words. At the deepest level, impermanence is none other than the activity of our spiritual source. Flow is the peristalsis of a formless womb. That formless womb gestates time, space, self, and world into existence moment by moment. Now, I am quite aware that this may seem like a very strange point of view to most people. Isn't the world always there? Isn't the self a thing? Aren't time and space a rigid, always existing stage? And if for an enlightened person, time, space, self, and world wink in and out of existence moment by moment, then how in God's name would such a person be able to function in the material world? There was a time when many people believed that lunar eclipses meant that a monster was eating the moon. If you didn't know any better, that might appear to be the case. As the eclipse progresses, you can imagine the outline of the monster's jaw biting deeper and deeper until the moon is swallowed. Almost no modern person would look at things that way. A shift in paradigm has occurred. The phenomenon of a lunar eclipse is now interpreted as the Earth's shadow moving across the moon. Eclipses still happen, just as they always have, and just as frequently as ever, yet they are not interpreted as before. For human beings, world and self seem to be solid objects. Time and space seem to be a rigid, always existing platform. This occurs for enlightened people and for unenlightened people. However, in the case of the enlightened person, a paradigm shift, a shift in interpretation has occurred. Before enlightenment, when self and world arose as solid objects, that person believed they really were solid. After enlightenment, self and world still arise as solid objects a lot of the time, but the enlightened person now knows that they appear to be solid only because he or she is not paying close attention right now. Even for a deeply enlightened person, the experience of contact with flow and emptiness does not necessarily go on uninterrupted. It may happen frequently during the day, but not necessarily continuously. Even a very liberated person still spends a lot of time experiencing the world in the ordinary way. What, then, is the difference between an ordinary person and a liberated person? The difference is a matter of freedom. An enlightened person has the ability to experience self and world as a source wave. And when they are not experiencing things that way, they understand why that is the case. It is just because they are not paying close attention. Freedom lies in being able to live in both of these worlds, the normal paradigm and the enlightened paradigm, and to know when to go to which, and to be able to do so anytime. That is why enlightenment is sometimes referred to as liberation. Liberated people live a lot of the time in their body-mind, just like anybody else, but they are not confined to it. When a liberated person drives their car to the local store, they go in and out of the two paradigms hundreds of times during that trip. Self as separate and seen as solid arise just in time to make the right turn, to beep the horn, or to signal, and they dissolve back into direct contact with the source wave. Then an instant later, it all congeals just in time to take the next action. Then they go back to the formless again. So even experiences as seemingly unspiritual as driving through rush hour on a smoggy Los Angeles freeway can be celestial, as pleasant and peaceful as sitting in a mountain hermitage. There is a story about this that I love to tell. You may have heard some quaint Zen stories from Asia, but this is a Zen story from the United States, one that happened in Los Angeles. Years ago, it was a fad for people to spend time in sensory deprivation tanks, tubs filled with high saline water so that you float like a cork, which more or less removes the sense of gravity. The water is body temperature, so you don't feel hot or cold, and the tank is light-proof and acoustically baffled, so no light or sound gets in. In such a simplified sensory environment, people tend to get very relaxed, and they also tend to go into interesting altered states. Some friends of mine owned a place where you could rent time in these contraptions, and they told me this story. They'd overheard a conversation between two Buddhist nuns from the Zen Center of Los Angeles. One was a senior practitioner, and the other was a relative neophyte. After they were finished with their sessions in the sensory deprivation tanks, the young nun said, "Wow, that was far out." To which the more senior nun replied, "Yeah, you're right. Really far out. It was exactly what I experience when I drive on the freeway."